It's Tuesday, the first day of July, 2025, and you're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader and Flagstaff, Chuck Kaufman, bringing you these headlines from the front page of the Wall Street Journal. Russia presses its advantage in troop size as front expands. Stocks sit at record highs after wild quarter. Firm offering private shares to the little guy stumbles. Starting with that first headline, Russia presses its advantage in troop size as front expands. This article is by Ian Lovett and Nikita Nikolienko. Sumy, Ukraine. Russian forces are just 12 miles from this northern Ukrainian regional capital, a new target for Moscow as the Kremlin presses its advantage in troop size at a growing number of places along the front. Having almost entirely ejected Ukrainian forces from the Russian Kursk region this year, Russian forces have now poured over the border in the opposite direction toward Sumy. With 50,000 troops in the area, they outnumber the Ukrainians roughly 3-1, according to soldiers fighting there. Their main strategy, General Oleksandr Syrsky, Ukraine's top military commander, said of the Russians, is to wear us down with their numbers. The Russian advance toward Sumy comes as President Trump has begun voicing growing frustration with the Kremlin's unwillingness to broker a ceasefire. Though meetings between Ukrainian and Russian officials have continued in Turkey throughout recent weeks, Moscow has stepped up its missile and drone attacks on Ukrainian cities during that same period. At nighttime on Sunday, Ukraine lost an F-16 fighter and its pilot during an aerial bombardment, the largest since the start of the war in terms of numbers of munitions launched. Over the past year, the front line has grown by more than 100 miles, Syrsky said, and stretches more than 750 miles in an arc from the northeast to the south. The Russians have been probing in different spots across the line, then pushing hard when they find one that gives, as they did in Sumy in May. That leaves Ukrainian commanders playing whack-a-mole, sending in elite units to help plug gaps. Ukraine in June sent elite commando units from its military intelligence directorate, known as HUR, to help stabilize the situation. Since then, the Russian advances in Sumy have been largely stopped, and Ukraine has clawed back some territory. Now we're looking for ways to conduct our own assaults and push the enemy back, said Timur, commander of the Timur Special Forces Unit, an elite unit of HUR that's been fighting in the region for several weeks. It isn't an easy task for Ukrainian forces, which are outnumbered nearly everywhere across the front. Their numbers are a big problem for us, though not enough to overrun us, said Kappa, commander of the Chimera unit of the Timur Special Forces Unit. The enemy is losing 300 to 400 people per day across the region, but they can deal with that level of casualties. They keep bringing in reserves. Soldiers in the area said that holding Sumy is coming at greater human cost than necessary. During the half-year that Ukraine held territory in Russia's Kursk region, soldiers who fought there said they assumed the military would be preparing strong defensive positions on the Ukrainian side of the border. Instead, after a chaotic and costly retreat from Kursk, they found outdated trenches with no overhead cover from drones. The soldiers are digging their own positions under drone fire in some cases. They also complained that areas the Russians are now advancing across weren't mined. It's like they prepared for tank columns, not a battlefield where dozens of drone strikes daily, said one infantry commander named Kryrylo, who fought in Kursk and is now fighting in Sumy. Every single day a position isn't ready is a day someone might not come back. Asked about fortifications last week, Defense Minister Rustem Umerov said the defensive lines in Sumy were being improved in threatened areas. Fortification is not just about concrete and trenches, it is an adaptive engineering system that takes the enemy's tactics into account and always serves one purpose: protecting our warriors. And thus Russia presses its advantage in troop size as front expands. Our next headline, stocks sit at record highs after wild quarter. S&P 500 has added more than 9% since Trump announced sweeping tariffs. This article is by Crystal Herr. An historic and tumultuous quarter ended with U.S. stocks at records and many investors betting the ride isn't over yet. The April swoon that carried the S&P 500 to the brink of a bear market has been erased and then some. The broad index has now added more than 9% since President Trump announced sweeping tariffs that sparked havoc in markets. Now investors have more reasons to feel upbeat. Both the S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite Index are hitting fresh all-time highs. Robust corporate earnings and solid economic data suggest that growth remains resilient. Inflation is trending near the Federal Reserve's 2% target. Banks that slashed their year-end targets for the S&P 500, such as J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs, are raising them again. Stocks gained Monday, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average adding about 0.6% or 275.5 points after the U.S. resumed trade talks with Canada, which rescinded a digital services tax that had led Trump to pause negotiations on Friday. The S&P 500 notched its best quarterly performance since 2023, and the NASDAQ saw its biggest quarterly jump since 2020. Markets can take some comfort in that we've, in a sense, weathered some of the storm, said Yung Yu Ma, chief investment strategist at PNC Asset Management. The worst is probably behind us. That optimism has fueled fresh gains for some recent stalwarts. The artificial intelligence trade has rebounded from a rocky start to the year when the emergence of Chinese upstart DeepSeek's AI model erased billions of dollars of value from NVIDIA and other tech giants. NVIDIA shares have climbed 18% this year, Meta Platforms has gained 26%, and Microsoft has added 18%. Shares of data analytics firm Palantir Technologies and chipmaker Broadcom are up 80% and 19%, respectively. The price of Bitcoin has climbed back above $100,000 with Trump, a Republican, reaffirming his promise to make the U.S. the crypto capital of the planet, and Congress seeking to advance legislation that could integrate crypto into the mainstream financial system. Coinbase led the recovery from the April lows, rising around 130%. At the same time, some warn that it's just a matter of time before tariffs hurt economic growth, rekindle inflation, and weigh on corporate earnings. Such worries have the Fed pausing its interest rate reductions, while concerns about Trump's tax bill and the massive U.S. deficit have weakened the dollar. The yield on the benchmark 10-year Treasury note settled at 4.227% to close out the first half below where it ended last year at 4.577%, according to TradeWeb. The U.S. has remained strong. That doesn't mean that the second half of the year will be easy, said Sarah Malik, chief investment officer at Nuveen. Whether the impact of tariffs shows up in inflation data, we've not seen that yet. I think we will see it in the next 2 to 3 months. Investors' worries have also manifested in a dizzying rally in Haven assets, including gold. Gold futures have posted a 25% gain in 2025, marking their best start to a year since 1979. A 24% gain in silver futures, meanwhile, marks their best first-half performance since 2016. Shares of economically resilient companies, such as utilities, which investors often buy when they're nervous about growth, have also outpaced the S&P's 500's year-to-date 5.5% gain. Meanwhile, stocks that tend to rise when the economy is booming, such as the consumer discretionary sector and small caps, are lagging behind. That's not just traditional bull market leadership, said David Lundgren, chief market strategist and portfolio manager at Little Harbor Advisors. This is not the time to pile into equities because you're kind of in a very broken, fragile, frayed environment. Adding to investors' concerns, some of the Magnificent Seven tech heavyweights that have powered market gains in recent years have lost their luster. Shares of Tesla have tumbled about 21% this year, dragged down by weak sales in China and consumer backlash to Elon Musk's role and later fallout with the Trump administration. Shares of Apple and Alphabet have declined about 18% and 7%, respectively, with investors worrying the companies have fallen behind in the AI race. Analysts polled by FactSet expect companies in the S&P 500 to report earnings growth of 9.4% this year, below the 14.3% they expected in January. Still, analysts project earnings will rise 13.7% next year. Many remain hopeful that the economy can dodge the worst of the trade fight and that negotiations will produce deals mitigating the fallout. And despite stocks looking pricey, the S&P 500 was recently trading at 22 times its expected earnings over the next 12 months, above its 10-year average of 18.7 times. Many think indexes can still rise from here. And that's stocks sit at record highs after wild quarter. Our next article is by Susan Pulliam and Corey Drybush. Firm offering private shares to the little guy stumbles. Link 2 faces investigations and a possible bankruptcy filing. In January 2023, the chief executive of the private stock investment firm Link 2 announced a Spike Day, a one-day sprint to boost sales to its customers, small investors looking for a shot at buying shares of coveted private companies. Take no prisoners, the now former CEO, William Saras, wrote in an email to staff reviewed by the Wall Street Journal. This is guerrilla warfare. Saras was trying to unload shares of Ripple, a privately held crypto company, to Link2's 11,000 users at a price at least 60% higher than what Link2 paid. The Securities and Exchange Commission generally prohibits markups above 10%, but Saras pushed ahead, not disclosing the price hike to customers, and the company pocketed $2 million, according to people close to the situation. An outside law firm later reviewed the transactions and warned that Link2's actions may constitute securities fraud, according to a memo reviewed by the Journal. Now it's looking even worse for Link2 and its customers. An internal investigation has turned up evidence that Link2 customers never owned the securities they thought they did and that the company was marketing to some investors who may not have been eligible to buy stakes in private companies in the first place, according to an internal memo. It's all ending badly, with the company barreling toward a possible restructuring through bankruptcy, according to the new management, and facing investigations of its practices by the SEC and Justice Department. Link2, which maintains about $500 million on behalf of thousands of investors around the world, was one of the earliest firms to capitalize on small investors' growing eagerness to buy into high-flying private companies. Its trading platform helped pioneer a private stock trading avenue for the little guy with fewer rules and less regulation than the public market. Its guerrilla tactics harked back to the days of boiler room trading, featuring blast emails and posts on social media hyping up stocks and playing on customers' fear of missing out, or FOMO, on new investments. Most of them sought after tech companies like Elon Musk's SpaceX and the artificial intelligence company Anthropic. Throw everything we have at this one targeted date. Influencers, marketing, ads, social calls, and smoke signals, Saras wrote to managers about Ripple. When one employee pushed back on promotional emails, citing worries by the company's lawyers about mentioning specific companies, he replied, "Forget what legal says." More than a half a dozen other platforms selling shares in private companies have opened to retail investors in recent years, including Start Engine, Hive, and Forge. High demand. During the pandemic, low interest rates and stimulus checks fueled individuals' desire to buy up private companies. The number of so-called unicorns, private companies valued at $1 billion or more, had shot up to around 1,275 from 90 a decade ago, according to CB Insights. Now the SEC and the Justice Department are looking into whether Link2 failed to adequately disclose its pricing practices and whether Saras sold shares customers thought they owned without telling them, according to a person familiar with the situation. Saras left his CEO post in March. That same month, Link2 acknowledged that an internal investigation had turned up serious securities law violations at the company. Much of what we discovered about the prior business practices at Linktoo is disturbing, said Dan Siciliano, Linktoo's new chief executive officer. These practices aren't small one-off compliance or common regulatory missteps. When contacted in early June about this story, a lawyer for Saras said at that time he had no comment. In March, Saras signed a memo alleging that the new management overstated the severity of Linktoo's violations of federal securities laws in a bid to seize control of the firm. A subcommittee of Linktoo's board found the allegations groundless. All of Linktoo's investors have been locked out of the holdings they believe they own because of the investigations, including those who invested in the Ripple Spike sale, and more recently in Circle, a crypto company that went public to much fanfare in June and whose stock is now trading at around 6 times its IPO price. The SEC permits accredited investors, or those with a net worth of more than $1 million or an annual salary of more than $200,000, to buy and sell private shares under the theory that these people should be sophisticated enough to navigate the potential hazards. There were 24.3 million U.S. households who qualified in 2022, compared with 1.5 million households in 1983, after income thresholds were first established, according to SEC estimates. John Deaton, a Massachusetts lawyer who attended board meetings as a customer representative, said he invested $495,000 of his net worth in private companies through Linktoo. Deaton was a believer in Linktoo's business model. The big investment firms have all these barriers of entry for real people, he says. But if Linktoo marked up prices on shares and misled its clients, then all they did was take advantage of unsophisticated investors, he says. Moody's Ratings warned recently that the push to sell private investments to retail investors could stress the financial system. At the same time, lawmakers are being lobbied by big private equity players and retail brokerages to make it easier for small investors to get into the market. Last year, Republicans on the Senate Banking Committee introduced a bill to allow any investor capable of passing an exam to buy private securities. Investor protection advocates have pushed back, saying changing the rule would water down necessary safeguards for investors while enriching Wall Street. Wizard of Oz. Linktoo's the San Jose offices are now mostly empty cubicles with the trading platform shut down. Saras, 74, majored in applied mathematics and talks often about his memory for trivia, including the stats for every baseball player, no matter the year. He and his wife, Vicky, founded Linktoo in 2010 and cycled through a series of ideas about what business it should pursue before landing on the private trading platform for retail investors. The company said it would make private equity investing easy and democratize the rarefied private markets. Greg Kidd, a neighbor at a San Francisco co-working space who became one of the first investors in Linktoo, had connections at Ripple, and he helped Saras get access to pre-IPO shares of the crypto company to sell on Linktoo. Other pre-IPO companies included the payment company Stripe and Fanatics, a sports merchandising company, followed. Saras gained the nickname Wizard of Oz because he pulled levers, controlling the firm's sales and strategy, often without telling anyone around him and without warning. He sometimes expressed disregard for Linktoo's lawyer, saying in one email, "If I think legal should be overridden, I will tell you." At town halls for the company, he laid out an ambitious vision, saying Linktoo would become a major player for selling private shares in the next multi-billion dollar company in the financial services industry, one attendee recalled. Linktoo rose in popularity as it advertised low investment minimums. Customers could buy stakes in their favorite private companies for as little as $1,000, compared with $10,000 or even $100,000 on other platforms with higher minimums. The company even allowed some people who weren't accredited investors to participate in the deals. Among them was Thomas Lennon, 33, who in September 2024 invested $10,000 in Ripple, the minimum amount for a promotion offering investment slots to 35 who weren't accredited, he said. "That's a lot of money for me," said Lennon, who said he was excited to have a chance to buy the crypto company. This is my first time dealing with private equity, he says, but says it was a chance I was willing to take because I wanted access to Ripple shares. With minimal checks about income and assets, customers like Lennon could start buying into private companies. Loyal users were encouraged to recruit their friends in order to earn Link2 bucks, credits they could use in their accounts. Saris and his team whipped up demand by blasting out emails and alerts suggesting that a hot private stock was in short supply, even when Link2 had access to plenty of more shares. Hours or days later, the company would follow up with emails announcing a sudden, supposedly new availability, emails show. The ultimate goal was to push the price of private stocks as high as possible, according to internal emails that were reviewed by the journal. In 2022, for instance, Saris urged a manager to increase the price of software company PolySign to $3.25 a share from $3 to boost Link2's revenue by $600,000. We can turn it into a unicorn via our platform, Saris said in an email. Link2 didn't just profit from selling shares of private companies to users. Sometimes the deals went the other direction. Ripple buyback. At the end of 2023, Link2 learned that Ripple, which remains private, was preparing to buy back shares from customers at roughly $61 each. Link2 reached out to customers who were in the black on their Ripple investments and convinced them to sell 144,000 shares of Ripple back to the company at an average of $55 per share, according to people close to the situation. It then sold them all to the crypto company at the higher offering price, booking more than $8 million in revenue. The SEC and Justice Department are investigating whether Saris improperly sold an additional 16,000 shares of Ripple without the permission of customers, according to people familiar with the situation. Link2 sought to ramp up its business by creating special purpose vehicles, or SPVs, to hold the shares. SPVs put investors one step away from actual ownership of shares because they own units of the SPVs rather than the stock itself. The SPVs allowed hundreds of new investors to buy into the SPVs without officially being registered as shareholders by the underlying company. It was a way around SEC requirements that limit the number of investors private businesses can have without going public. It also allows smaller investors to buy pieces of very expensive private companies. Pushing boundaries. Link2 created more than 500 of these vehicles, and the plan was to put customers' investments in these funds. But it isn't clear if the shares were ever formally put into the SPVs, according to company documents and current employees, throwing into doubt the identity of the actual owners of the shares. In its rush to sign up more users, Link2 also pushed other boundaries, buying email lists that contained prospective customers from sanctioned nations, such as Iran and North Korea. They signed up roughly 100 customers who said they were from those countries, according to people close to the situation. The customers didn't end up buying shares through the platform, these people say, but businesses are prohibited from even recruiting from blacklisted countries. By early 2024, Link2's business was thriving and it boasted nearly 750,000 registered users on its platform. By the time it shut down, there were well-heeled customers, including about 80 customers who invested $500,000 or more, and about 20 who invested more than $1 million. In April of 2024, the company announced a $700 million merger with a publicly traded special purpose acquisition company, or SPAC, a deal that would have netted Saris and other executives millions of dollars in stock. Damning memo. Ahead of the deal, Link2 hired an external law firm to conduct a review of its business practices. The law firm came back with a damning 18-page memo written a few months after the Ripple spike day, warning the company that it was potentially violating multiple federal laws, including anti-fraud provisions of U.S. securities laws. The external lawyers advised Link2 to immediately cease charging markups for shares. In September 2024, Link2 abandoned the SPAC merger. A short time later, the SEC informed the company it was starting an investigation into its business. Linktu's own lawyers were also sending warning signals. In an 8-page memo, they worried that its tactics were potentially illegal and outlined roughly a dozen recommended changes, including no longer allowing its customers to self-certify that they were accredited and avoiding any possible exposure to severe civil or even criminal penalties, according to the memo. SEC cooperation. In January 2025, Linktu brought in new managers led by Dan Siciliano, the founder of a smaller startup that offered employees of private tech companies a way to sell their shares. Siciliano, who was hired as an eventual successor to Saris, brought in another law firm, Sullivan & Cromwell. People familiar with the matter said Linktu began cooperating with the SEC investigation at that point. The DOJ launched its own probe in early 2025, according to a person close to the situation. The new CEO, Siciliano, is bracing for a fight with customers, but said in an interview he believes there is a path that preserves their value. These days, Linktu customers, once giddy about private market investments, are anxious about whether they'll get access to their investments or even get their money back. A group of customers, many supportive of prior management, recently launched a grassroots campaign to try and free Linktu. If Linktu files for bankruptcy, reorganization in the coming days, as people close to the situation say is expected, its customers will likely be transformed into unsecured creditors who will have to wait in line to get paid. And that's firm offering private shares to the little guy stumbles. You're listening to the Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Remember, you can listen to Sun Sounds of Arizona programming, like the Wall Street Journal, at a time of your choosing or as it streams on either the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or the Sun Sounds of Arizona app. That app is available from the Apple App Store for your iPad or iPhone or the Google Play Store for your Android phone or tablet. And of course, you can always listen to the Sun Sounds of Arizona stream on your Amazon Dot or Echo. Well, let's turn now to the business and finance section of the Wall Street Journal for these headlines. Amazon nears robotics milestone. Robinhood goes all in on crypto with mix of services. And new Meta division focuses on AI effort. That first headline is by Sebastian Herrera. Amazon nears robotics milestone. E-commerce giant will soon have as many robots as staff in warehouse. The automation of Amazon.com facilities is approaching a new milestone. Here there will soon be as many robots as humans. The e-commerce giant, which has spent years automating tasks previously done by humans in its facilities, has deployed more than 1 million robots in those workplaces, Amazon said. That's the most it's ever had, near the count of human workers at the facilities. Company warehouses buzz with metallic arms plucking items from shelves and wheeled droids that motor around the floors, ferrying the goods for packaging. In other corners, automated systems help sort the items, which other robots assist in packaging for shipment. One of Amazon's newer robots, called Vulcan, has a sense of touch that enables it to pick items from numerous shelves. Amazon has taken recent steps to connect its robots to its order fulfillment processes so the machines can work in tandem with each other and with humans. They're one step closer to that realization of the full integration of robotics, said Ruben Scriven, research manager at Interact Analysis, a robotics consulting firm. Now, some 75% of Amazon's global deliveries are assisted in some way by robotics, the company said. The growing automation has helped Amazon improve productivity while easing pressure on the company to solve problems such as heavy staff turnover at its fulfillment centers. For some Amazon workers, the increasing automation has meant replacing menial, repetitive work, lifting, pulling, and sorting, with more skilled assignments managing the machines. I thought I was going to be doing heavy lifting. I thought I was going to be walking like crazy, said Nisha Cruz, who spent 5 years picking items at an Amazon warehouse in Windsor, Connecticut, before she was trained to oversee robotic systems. Today, she sits in front of a computer screen in a Tempe, Arizona office, making sure mobile robots inside Amazon facilities across the U.S. are working properly. She earns about 2.5 times as much pay as she did when she started at Amazon. Robots are also supplanting some employees, helping the company to slow hiring. Amazon employs about 1.56 million people overall, with the majority working in warehouses. The average number of employees Amazon had per facility last year, roughly 670, was the lowest recorded in the past 16 years, according to a Wall Street Journal analysis, which compared the company's reported workforce with estimates of its facility count. The number of packages that Amazon ships itself per employee each year has also steadily increased since at least 2015 to about 3,870 from about 175, the analysis found, an indication of the company's productivity gains. Some of Amazon's newer facilities, such as those built for same-day delivery, have smaller employee footprints and help us deliver with greater speed, a company spokesman said. Amazon is also rolling out artificial intelligence in its warehouses, Chief Executive Andy Jassy said recently, to improve inventory placement, demand forecasting, and the efficiency of our robots. Amazon said it will cut the size of a total workforce in the next several years. The second largest private employer in the U.S., Amazon is a bellwether for a range of businesses automating work around the country. Its rollout of robots shows how technological advances are accelerating, transforming factory floors, and rippling through labor markets. The company began introducing advanced robotics to its warehouses after it paid $775 million in 2012 to buy Kiva Systems, which made robots that ferried shelves of products around. Early on, robots moved large amounts of unpackaged items, a physically difficult task for a human to do. Over time, machines began taking on even more challenging assignments, such as packaging, sorting products, and lifting heavy items. Amazon's automation advances are on display at its 3 million square feet facility in Shreveport, Louisiana. There, more than 6 dozen robotic arms sort, stack, and consolidate millions of items. Robots also zip carts of packages for loading onto trucks, help package customer paper bags for orders, and transport products to be in position for packaging. Robots perform several tasks working with humans. The robotic system that helps sort inventory moves products to an employee who then picks the items that fill an order. Another reaches for hard-to-grab items inside shelves with the supervision of a human worker. Products move 25% faster through the facility than at other sites. Amazon has trained more than 700,000 workers across the world for higher-paying jobs that can include working with robotics, the company said. You have completely new jobs being created, such as robot technicians, said Yesh Dattariya, senior applied scientist at Amazon Robotics. And that's Amazon Near's robotics milestone. Our next headline, Robinhood goes all in on crypto with mix of services. This is by Vicky Gi Huang and Hannah Aaron Lang. Robinhood Markets, the brokerage upstart that drew in millions of traders during the COVID-era meme stock frenzy, is making a significant push into crypto by launching a wave of new services designed to make its app a central hub for digital assets. The brokerage's new products will allow customers to do more than simply buy and sell cryptocurrencies. Robinhood will follow crypto exchanges Kraken and Gemini in announcing plans to offer tokenized stocks to overseas customers. As of Monday, the company's European investors were able to trade more than 200 U.S. stocks and exchange-traded funds over a digital ledger and with zero commissions. Such tokenized equities would make it easier for foreign customers to access U.S. stocks such as Apple, Tesla, and Nvidia, as well as popular exchange-traded funds, including the SPDR S&P 500 ETF, around the clock. Robinhood also plans to offer tokenized shares of privately owned companies to customers. the trading platform is making stock tokens of OpenAI and SpaceX available to eligible European users this summer, executives said at a crypto event Monday. Robinhood said it is developing its own blockchain, which in time will be used to record transactions for tokenized stocks. The brokerage also plans to roll out perpetual futures on Bitcoin and Ether for its European customers by the end of the summer. Perpetual futures are contracts that allow traders to continuously make leveraged bets, and they never expire, Robinhood said. Eligible traders will be able to trade perpetual futures with up to 3x leverage on its platform. In the U.S., Robinhood is launching crypto staking for Ethereum and Solana. Staking is a way for investors to earn rewards by pledging their cryptocurrencies to a blockchain to help validate transactions for a specified period. The Securities and Exchange Commission cracked down on staking under the Biden administration, arguing that it constituted an unregistered security and forcing Kraken to stop offering crypto staking services in the U.S. while hitting it with a $30 million fine. Kraken relaunched staking for U.S. customers in some states earlier this year. Robinhood's aggressive push into crypto comes as Bitcoin is trading near its recent record, with President Trump embracing digital assets and Congress seeking to advance legislation that could make cryptocurrencies part of the mainstream financial system. The company has steadily expanded its market share in crypto with its recent acquisitions of crypto exchange BitsAmp and Canadian crypto financial services company WonderFi. Crypto forms a key part of Chief Executive Vlad Tenev's ambitious plan to transform Robinhood into a global, comprehensive financial services firm. Despite its speculative and volatile nature, crypto trading has become a source of significant transaction revenue for the brokerage since its introduction on the platform in 2018. And that's Robinhood Goes All In on Crypto with Mix of Services. Next, we have new Meta division focuses on AI effort. This is by Megan Bobrowski. Mark Zuckerberg announced a new superintelligence division within Meta Platforms, officially recognizing an effort that's been the subject of an intense recruiting blitz in recent months. Former Scale CEO Alexander Wang will lead the team as Chief AI Officer, and former GitHub CEO Nat Friedman will lead the company's work on AI products, according to an internal memo Zuckerberg sent to employees that was viewed by the Wall Street Journal. The new organization, called Meta Superintelligence Labs, will house Meta's fundamental AI research team, also known as FAIR, or FAIR. The team that currently builds the company's Llama models and the team that develops Meta's AI products, as well as a new lab focused on developing the next generation of our models. Zuckerberg also announced 11 new hires for the team, several from OpenAI, two from Google DeepMind, and one from Anthropic. Meta has also hired three additional OpenAI employees from its Zurich office, the journal previously reported. As the pace of AI progress accelerates, developing superintelligence is coming into sight, he wrote in the memo. I believe this will be the beginning of a new era for humanity, and I'm fully committed to doing what it takes for Meta to lead the way. Zuckerberg has been on a hiring spree the past few months, personally reaching out to hundreds of top AI researchers in an effort to get his company out of an AI crisis. Meta released its latest versions of its Llama model in April to little fanfare and later delayed the launch of another bigger version of the model. He is racing to create cutting-edge artificial intelligence technology that's smarter than humans and able to power a wave of innovation that he has envisioned for his company. In recent months, Zuckerberg has painted a vision of a future where people have AI friends, create advertising concepts from scratch with AI, and talk to AI business agents when they need to get in touch with a merchant. He also plans to spend upwards of $70 billion on capital expenditures, much of it on AI investments. Part of the way to achieve his goals is hiring and retaining top talent. Meta has struggled with employee turnover and a series of restructurings. Zuckerberg has sought to turn things around by compiling a list of the brightest minds in the industry and offering them million-dollar pay packages, sometimes even $100 million. In his note to employees, Zuckerberg said there are more great people at all levels joining this effort in the coming weeks. That's new Meta division focuses on AI effort. Our next article is by Hannah Miao. Firms struggles to move out of China. Phnom Penh, Cambodia. For the first time in nearly two decades of visiting factories in Asia, Ryan Bursky's business trip didn't include a stop in China. Until last year, his company's products, lamps and other lighting goods sold to retailers, including Walmart and Home Depot, were made in China. President Trump's first-term tariffs on Chinese goods pushed him to find an alternative. That's how Bursky ended up in Cambodia. At the end of 2024, he had moved a quarter of production from China to Cambodia. Within a few months, that became 70%. The goal of a trip in June, transfer all of his products out of China. Bursky's efforts are emblematic of a push by American businesses to reconfigure global supply chains for a new era of economic warfare. Currently, lamps from China are subject to duties of about 60%, including new levies imposed by Trump since his return to office this year. Imports from Cambodia briefly faced a 49% tariff as part of Trump's Liberation Day blitz, but dropped to 10% as trade negotiations continue. Bursky is betting the U.S. will keep tariffs on China at a higher level while limiting levies on Cambodian goods. That's what we're hoping and banking on, Bursky said, as he drove to visit his suppliers roughly an hour outside Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh. In the passenger seat sat Sung Furong, the owner of one of those factories. Sun's lighting factory in China, LightSun, has been a supplier for Bursky's company, Lucidity Lights, since 2020. Moving production to Cambodia has so far proven fruitful for Bursky, helping his company win new contracts from retailers that are looking for suppliers outside China. His company is on track to increase revenue about 40% this year, a jump he attributes in part to his move to Cambodia. Though the difference in tariff rates makes Cambodian products cheaper to import, it's been more expensive to produce lamps because of logistics costs tied to inputs sourced from China. Bursky and his manufacturers are working to lower costs by moving more of their supply chains to Cambodia. They're trying to recreate the ecosystem of suppliers developed over decades that turned China into a manufacturing superpower. Bursky, 42 years old, spent his entire career in the lighting industry. As a child, he helped out at his family's lighting showroom in a suburb of Cleveland. After working his way up at various lighting companies, he was recruited to run operations at Boston-based Lucidity in 2023 and later promoted to chief executive. A few years earlier, Lucidity acquired part of a company that filed for bankruptcy after struggling with Trump's first-term tariffs. Bursky's task? Start moving production out of China. Since Trump's first term, Cambodia's manufacturing industry has boomed. Cambodia's goods exports to the U.S. have quadrupled in value since 2017, making up more than one-third of all products exported from Cambodia in 2024. Those exports to the U.S. were equivalent to about one-fifth of Cambodia's gross domestic product last year. As a poor country, Cambodia doesn't import as much from the U.S. America's goods trade deficit with Cambodia ballooned to more than $12 billion in 2024 from less than $3 billion in 2017. That put Cambodia in the crosshairs when the Trump administration recalculated reciprocal tariffs based on trade deficits. The Trump administration is wary of Chinese manufacturing moving to Cambodia and elsewhere in the Southeast Asia, which some officials see as a backdoor for Chinese goods to enter the U.S. market. China has made up about two-thirds of foreign direct investment in Cambodia last year, according to the World Bank. Cambodia in May implemented tighter regulations on rules of origin and certification procedures for certain exports to the U.S., which local business leaders interpreted as a move to appease U.S. concerns about illegal transshipments. The Trump administration continues to have productive discussions with each of our trading partners, White House spokesman Kush Desai said in a statement emphasizing the administration's commitment to addressing transshipment and other tactics that undermine our tariff policies. In Sun's 350,000 square foot facility, according to Sun, goods made there have more than 40% of their value added in Cambodia through local labor, above the 35% value threshold required to qualify as the country of origin. Her 400 local workers earn a little over a dollar an hour on average, plus overtime and holiday pay. In China, her workers make about $3 an hour. Sun imports raw materials and components from China that she said aren't currently available in Cambodia. Chinese employees come for short stints to train local managers on new production processes. More parts are being made in Cambodia. When Bursky last visited Sun's factory a few months before, she was still buying plugs from China that would be assembled into lamps in Cambodia. This time, she showed him how workers turned raw copper into wire wrapped in plastic insulation with metal pins to plug into outlets. The strategy has been piece by piece, step by step, to move components here, said Bursky, whose company employs a dozen people in the U.S. The fewer materials Bursky's suppliers in Cambodia need to ship from China, the cheaper and more efficient production becomes. It normally takes 45 days to produce a new order in China, but Bursky has to add roughly 30 more days for production in Cambodia. Any delays can lead to missed deadlines and fees from retailers. Supplies from China are often held up at customs. Manufacturers say Cambodia's government is worried about Chinese companies importing finished goods for transshipment to U.S. customers. During Bursky's visit in mid-June, Sun had 6 containers of materials awaiting clearance for more than a week. Another Lucidity supplier across the street has faced similar delays. There is the threat of fresh tariffs from Trump. During Bursky's last Asia trip in March, he and Sun visited one of her ceramic suppliers in China on what he called a diplomatic mission to persuade the owner to open a factory in Cambodia. The owner agreed, but then Trump's Liberation Day tariffs put the decision on pause. Still, Cambodia has its advantages. Though its population of around 17 million people is relatively small, roughly two-thirds are under 35, and Cambodia has one of the highest labor force participation rates in the region. The process for making the lamps can't easily be automated. The decorative home goods industry demands new designs each season, like fast fashion. For that reason, Bursky and Sun said this type of manufacturing is all but impossible to move back to the U.S., where labor costs are much higher and supply networks are less robust. Sun has poured $10 million into opening the factory in Cambodia and is still in the red. Bursky, facing pressure from his retailer customers, continually asks Sun for price reductions, eating away at her already thin margins. But they need each other to make their businesses work. "We're married, whether we like it or not," Bursky said. And that's firm struggles to move out of China. Our next article, Banks Turn to AI-Powered Digital Workers. This is by Isabel Busquet. Bank of New York Mellon said it now employs dozens of artificial intelligence-powered digital employees that have company logins and work alongside its human staff. Similar to human employees, these digital workers have direct managers they report to and work autonomously in areas like coding and payment instruction validation, said Chief Information Officer Leanne Russell. Soon, they'll have access to their own email accounts and may even be able to communicate with colleagues in other ways, like through Microsoft Teams, she said. "This is the next level," Russell said. "While it's still early for the technology," Russell said, "I'm sure in 6 months' time it will become very, very prevalent." What the bank, also known as BNY, calls digital workers, other banks may refer to as AI agents. And while the industry lacks a clear consensus on exact terminology, it is clear that technology has a growing presence in financial services. Others aren't necessarily taking the same approach of granting their AI full logins, but many say they're shaping AI into applications that increasingly replicate the capabilities and workflows of human employees, taking on more and more tasks in areas like the software development lifecycle and research. Several, like JPMorgan Chase, say they're still figuring out the exact right access and management controls and system integrations and how human-like these tech systems will become. BNY said it took 3 months for its AI hub to spin up two digital employee personas, one designed to clean up vulnerabilities in code and one designed to validate payment instructions. Each persona can exist in a few dozen instances, and each instance is assigned to work narrowly within a particular team, Russell said. That way, no digital employee has broad access to information across the company, she added. Because they have their own logins and can directly access the same apps as human employees, they can work autonomously, said Russell. For example, a digital engineer can log into company systems and see there's a vulnerability that needs to be patched, write the new code to patch it, and then pass it on to a human manager for approval in the system. BNY said it's aiming to grant its digital workforce access to more enterprise communication systems such as email and Microsoft Teams, allowing them to proactively contact their human managers for issues they can't solve. It's also working to build digital employees that go beyond coding and payment instruction validation into other areas. The bank said it will continue to hire top human talent while also building out more digital employees. At JPMorgan Chase, Chief Analytics Officer Derek Waldron thinks of digital employees as more of a helpful model for business people to conceptualize AI tools. They're fundamentally different from human employees, of course, but also traditional software systems, and so they may need their own type of system connectivity and access management, he said. It is an open question exactly how much or how little access to give an agent and is going to have to be figured out on a case-by-case basis, he said. And while it isn't clear exactly what it will look like, he does envision a future in which every employee will have an AI assistant and every client experience will have an AI concierge. Scott Mullins, Managing Director, AWS for Financial Services, said, "The question of how to integrate digital workers with a human workforce is top of mind across the finance industry. How do we coordinate that work together?" he said. "When it comes to digital workers," he added, "how do we manage those folks? How do we actually instruct those folks? What's the new operating model?" Those are the answers that we're all working on right now. And that's Bank's turn to AI-powered digital workers. We have time for one more article. This is from the Heard on the Street section of Financial Analysis and Commentary. Investors are right to love dividends. The payouts often aren't about income, and that's all right. It turns out that caring about dividends can really pay dividends. Finance professors have long tisk-tisk about investors' love for cash payouts, but a recent report shows what people actually do with them and why they prefer receiving cash. Because it works. One of the original studies on dividends in the early 1960s said people shouldn't care about the payouts. Maximizing wealth is the point, and dividends are just a part of investors' total return. Any cash a company pays out reduces its value by an equal amount, after all. Then the rise of behavioral finance acknowledged people aren't robots and tried figuring out why receiving checks 4 times a year is so alluring. The partial answer was that we put things such as interest and dividends in the same mental bucket as wages, income we feel comfortable spending. We view capital differently and are loath to touch it, even though it's possible to sell appreciated stock and create your own dividend. It was still a head-scratcher, though. A 1970s paper called The Dividend Puzzle recognized that people prefer them, but said the pieces just don't fit together. A recent study of data, thousands of Vanguard customers, by finance professor Mir Stotman and Vanguard managers Paolo Costa and Sharon Hill seems puzzling too, at first. It compares people who own dividend income funds to plain vanilla equity funds. Instead of buying the dividend funds for actual income, though, investors were just about as likely to reinvest the money. Both groups mostly did, especially if they weren't retired yet. That's a little bit like wanting to drive really fast, but buying a Toyota Corolla. Possible, but not really what it was designed for. Stotman and his team dug deeper. When asked their reasons, many investors said they didn't need the money now, but thought stocks that paid dividends had higher returns and were less volatile. And they're right. Data from the past 50 years compiled by Ned Davis Research shows that the annualized return of dividend payers in the S&P 500 was 9.2%, compared with only 4.3% for non-payers and with less choppiness, too. Dividend payers would have left you with 10 times as much wealth before taxes over that time as non-payers. They also easily beat an equal-weighted basket of all companies in the index. It's like buying that Corolla instead of a sports car because you know it's reliable and will take you farther. But don't confuse cause and effect. One of the best stocks of all time has never paid a dividend. Well, almost never. Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway once paid 10 cents in 1967. Buffett quipped that he must have been in the bathroom when the decision was taken. Owning Berkshire has been spectacular and probably would have been less so if it had made regular cash payments, even if you had reinvested them after taxes. The secret seems to be that companies paying chunky dividends also tend to have value and quality characteristics. Those are two factors associated with long-term investment success and also describe Berkshire's portfolio. Value is present because dividend payers have profits from which to pay them. And those payouts are meaningful enough as a percentage of their price to land them in an income fund. Well, that's all the time that we have for that article, Investors Are Right to Love Dividends. That was by Spencer Jacob. You've been listening to The Wall Street Journal here on Sun Sounds of Arizona with your volunteer reader, Chuck Kaufman. Thank you for joining me for this Tuesday edition, the 1st of July. And remember that you can listen to The Wall Street Journal and other Sun Sounds of Arizona productions streaming on the Sun Sounds of Arizona website at sunsounds.org or the Sun Sounds of Arizona app available for your iPad or iPhone from the Apple App Store or for your Android phone or tablet from the Google Play Store. And of course, it always streams on the Amazon Dot or Echo.